From KLW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents, context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Oh, Redwood City, California.
Hayward?
Near Richmond, Richmond District, kind of.
I'm from Concord.
Martinez.
Hercules.
I'm from Marina, California.
SF State, wherever that is.
Coming up, we'll hear how the Oakland Police Department is faring 9 years after a judge said it had to make fundamental changes or face a takeover.
Now we're on like a fourth police chief, a third mayor, 9 years in. And we're still working at it.
Then we'll take a look at the future of voting online.
Yeah, unfortunately, while the idea is attractive on the surface, it doesn't hold up to scrutiny.
And what does it take to design a U.S. postal stamp from conception to execution?
I can just tell you that this process is never succinct.
Neither is producing an edition of Cross Currents. This one is made mail order just for you. If you were a police officer in Oakland in the 1990s, two things dominated your work life. The city's staggering crime rate.
Hear this message. Crime and disrespect for the rights of others won't be tolerated. Period. That's all there is to it.
And later, the fallout from a lawsuit against four officers who called themselves the Riders. In 2000, over 100 plaintiffs came forward to accuse the officers of kidnapping, false imprisonment, assault with a deadly weapon, and battery.
Ultimately, we wound up representing 129 people who did a total of 40 years for crimes they didn't do.
The ensuing lawsuit put a spotlight on the department, and it led to what's called the Negotiated Settlement Agreement. That is a 5-year legal plan to bring accountability into the Oakland police force. But 9 years have now passed, and the department still sees a record number of complaints. Hanging in the balance is control of the force. If it doesn't change course, the OPD may become the first major American police department taken over by the federal government. Reporter Joaquin Palomino explains what this means for the Oakland police.
Sue Taylor has lived in Oakland for the past 40 years. At age 64, she's had an eventful life.
I've done a lot of things professionally. I've served on corporate boards, charitable boards, volunteering in the schools, coaching my son's Little League team.
But for 3 years, one event consumed most of her time.
I'm doing a drive-through tour of an experience I had with the Oakland Police Department in early April 2004.
Taylor was stopped on 29th Street. She looked both ways before crossing the intersection, but she missed a car coming straight at her.
At which point I was hit and the front of my car was torn off, pulled over into a red zone, and that began my saga.
Taylor says the man who hit her became hostile and refused to give up his information. In fear for her safety, she called the police, who gave her permission to leave the area. While driving her wrecked car home, a cop pulled up behind her and switched on his sirens. Taylor got out of her car.
At which point the police officer said, "You're a hit and run! You're a hit and run!" And I kept saying, "There's a mistake. There's a mistake. This isn't a hit and run. I've been given permission to come home."
After what seemed like hours of arguing,
he literally attacked me. Jumped on me, wrenched my right arm up behind my back in what I later was told, and he testified to in court, was a pain hold. He pulled me out to the sidewalk and pushed me down on top of his patrol car, banging my mouth, and there was blood down the front of me.
She was placed in custody for disturbing the peace and resisting arrest. This began a 3-year legal battle that ended with a $40,000 civil rights settlement. Taylor's ordeal came on the heels of the landmark Riders case in 2003. Out of that lawsuit came what's called the Negotiated Settlement Agreement, or NSA. It's a 5-year, 51-point plan meant to curb police misconduct. Since it was signed, the department has complied with 80% of the agreement. But at the same time, it's maintained a record level of complaints.
There's been a lot of cases, even since the NSA, which happened in 2003. I certainly have been involved in many of them.
Civil rights attorney John Burris represented the plaintiffs in the Riders case and co-wrote the agreement.
A lot of police shooting cases, strip search cases. We're involved in another case that almost 100 people involved in misuse of search warrant.
In the past decade, one officer was accused of sexually harassing 20 Asian women. Another officer beat a man so severely that his ribs broke and he died of pneumonia. Court documents suggest a cover-up, but the officer was still promoted to captain. All of these lawsuits ended in hefty settlements, which over the decade have cost Oakland around $60 million. That's more than San Jose and San Francisco combined.
The most commonly reported complaints are for excessive force and rudeness.
Rashida Granach directs the multipurpose community group Pueblo, and since 1990, she's filed away every grievance made against the OPD. In 2010, Granach compared her collection for the year to San Francisco's.
We actually had three times the number of complaints filed against police officers than San Francisco did, even though San Francisco's police force is three times larger than our force.
Despite the high number of complaints, most observers say the department has improved since the dark days of the rioters.
And there's been a total sea change as far as how we operate and the numbers of officers that are here now.
That's Barry Donnellan, president of the Oakland Police Officers Association.
Well, the negotiated settlement agreement has laid a series of processes on the department that have set a series of checks and balances in place.
At a recent OPD open house for the community, I spoke with Deputy Chief Sean Wendt. He's been with the force for 16 years, and he says he's seen the progress firsthand.
I think that we're more forward-thinking now. We try and slow down and do things more responsibly.
Since 2003, the department has implemented an entirely new training program and crowd control policy. They also have a system in place that ensures only the best cops are promoted.
We've drastically changed our internal affairs process so that every complaint that comes in gets investigated, whereas in the past some may have just been filed. We do much better investigations of uses of force, even low-level uses of force.
Court-appointed monitors and a federal judge regularly check up on the department's progress. Only 20% of the agreement remains incomplete, but of those items, most are just a few percentage points shy of being checked off the list.
We're in the ballpark at this point, so now it's just really fine-tuning to get that last little bit.
But there's concern that reforms are stagnant. The department has already been granted two extensions, and in the last two quarterly reports, they've made little to no progress. Again, Attorney John Burris.
And so now we're on like a fourth police chief, a third mayor, 9 years in, and we're still working at it. It's not easy. We've had a lot of resistance in getting that done.
Earlier this year, federal monitor Robert Warshaw accused the department of continuing to protect problem officers, a concern shared by attorney Jim Channon.
Out of 700 officers, the main problems are done by 20 or 25 officers.
What, I guess, makes them, in your mind, the primary problem?
They'd kill people for no reason. They'd beaten people for no reason. They'd arrested people for no reason. They'd cost the city millions of dollars.
Federal Judge Thelton Henderson is especially concerned with officer-involved shootings. Between 2004 and 2008, roughly 20 unarmed people were shot by the OPD. A third of them died. Still, none of the officers involved were punished. One case that's recently drawn scrutiny involved 27-year-old Jody Woodfox.
Officer Hector Jimenez was fired from OPD in 2008 for shooting an unarmed man after a suspected DUI traffic stop. The city paid $650,000 to the victim's family to settle a wrongful death lawsuit.
John Burris represented the Woodfox family.
You find out all the facts that suggested that number one, he was unarmed, number two, he was running away, and that while he's running away, he shot running away three times in the back. That has all the appearance of murder.
No father figure in their life is what's blamed upon thee. My dad gunned down by OPD. But sorrow is.
That's one of Jody Woodfox's three children, Mac, reading a poem titled The Average Black Man. He recited it a year after his father was killed on a TV program called We Poets.
They think they're mad now? Well, you just wait and see. I'll give them something to be mad about. Because me, I refuse to be the average black man.
How I feel towards the Oakland police officers in regards to the shooting of my brother would be anger towards Officer Jimenez.
Jody Woodfox's sister, Kenita Vaughn, still can't believe how her brother was killed.
Just anger, like, mainly because...
4 months before Woodfox was shot, Officer Jimenez was involved in a very similar incident.
Andrew meant a lot to us.
Sonia Wani's son, Andrew Maupin Buckskin, was one of five people killed by Oakland police last year.
He shot and killed Andrew Maupin Buckskin, who was unarmed, as he fled arrest. Officer Jimenez was fired for killing the two men, but last year a labor arbitrator ordered that Jimenez be rehired with full back pay. This has Kenita Vaughn baffled.
It makes us, feel unprotected, unsafe. We look at the Oakland police as being a gang themselves. And, we just have this misplaced fear, like there's no trust.
People look at the police department and they paint it with a broad brush. You know, all cops are like that. And really, you can't look at any group in society and judge them all together, right? I mean, people are individuals. So if there are bad cops, we as the police department have to address that. But we don't think it's reflective upon the population at large of police officers.
Deputy Chief Sean Wendt understands why police community relations are strained, but he hopes people can have faith in the department's ability to change.
We have made good strides since Chief Jordan took over, and I think that we will be able to actually get this in compliance this year.
Hopefully he's right, because time and patience are starting to wear thin. The department has a backlog of countless complaints from the Occupy protests, and Judge Henderson recently ordered investigations into officer-involved shootings. Attorneys John Burris and Jim Channon are currently preparing a motion to place the department under federal receivership, a first in the nation. If granted, no one knows what that would look like, but officials believe it will be an expensive endeavor for this city, especially when it's $58 million in debt. In Oakland, I'm Joaquin Palomino for Cross Currents.
And you can hear both parts of Joaquin's reports on the Ryder's case and the Oakland police and the rest of all of our criminal justice coverage at our website, kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. I'm Holly Kernan. Another government agency facing scrutiny these days is the U.S. Postal Service. Last month, 14 current and retired postal workers in Washington, D.C. and the state of Washington began a one-week hunger strike.
Congress is starving the Postal Service, and the idea of a hunger strike is really a metaphor, a good metaphor, for what's happening, what we're trying to tell the public.
David Yao is one of the workers protesting Congress's decision to require the Postal Service to make mandatory health care and pension contributions. Some employees believe it's making the organization unprofitable. It's no secret that the Postal Service is experiencing serious financial problems. Last September, Megan Breenan, the chief operating officer of the U.S. Postal Service, announced that the company is downsizing its operations by fully or partly closing more than 100 processing centers across the country.
We simply need fewer facilities to process less mail.
But the fact that this is happening in an election year troubles California Secretary of State Deborah Bowen.
I'm very concerned about the closing of processing centers and have urged the post office and the Congress to delay the closure of any processing centers until after the November election.
It's serious business. About half of all California voters have chosen to vote by mail and therefore rely on the post office to deliver their ballots on time, which, we should point out, wasn't necessarily happening before the downsizing. The U.S. Election Assistance Commission says about 26,000 ballots arrived too late to be counted in California's general election in 2010. So what is the future of voting by mail? And what are the alternatives? KALW's RTM's Kunahoffs went searching for some answers.
Here is the issue. On one hand, it's important to satisfy the growing demand of citizens to vote without going to polling places. Such demand has increased dramatically over the last three decades. In 1978, only 4.4% of Californians who participated in elections voted by mail. By 2010, it was up to 48%. This means almost 5 million ballots are turned in by mail in California. The main reason for the increase is simple, says Public Policy Institute of California research fellow Eric McGee.
It's definitely a convenience thing. It has made possible for the United States something approximating an early voting system.
But with the imminent downsizing of the Postal Service, it's not sustainable. So what are the solutions? One answer is quite simple, a postmark-based system. Currently, ballots need to arrive no later than 8 p.m. on election day to be counted. Secretary of State Deborah Bowen would like to count all ballots that have been stamped by the post office by the end of election day.
The specifics are up for debate, but if we're going to continue to have downgrades in the mail system, I think we won't have much choice if we want to continue a voting by mail system. And as you noted, it's very popular.
The idea of voting by mail began as a way to improve voter turnout. But since it became available to everyone in 1978, the percentage of eligible Californians who vote has actually dropped from 48 to 44%. So another idea to boost voter turnout is to move Election Day from a Tuesday to a weekend, so that more people could vote at polling places.
Why do we vote on Tuesday? Does anybody know? Here's the answer. Absolutely no good reason whatsoever.
Jacob Soboroff is executive director of a group called Why Tuesday. In February, he gave a talk at the TED conference in Palm Springs, California.
In 1845, Americans traveled by horse and buggy. As did I, evidently. It took a day or longer to get to the county seat to vote, a day to get back, and you couldn't travel on the Sabbath. So Tuesday it was.
Tuesdays were the most convenient days for farmers, their so-called court day, when they were usually in town to take care of business, so they could vote too. America is no longer such an agrarian society, and many think the time has come to acknowledge that in elections.
The gentleman from New York is recognized for 1 minute.
I thank the chairman.
A bill called the Weekend Voting Act was introduced to the U.S. House of Representatives back in 2009 and reintroduced this March by Democrats John Larson from Connecticut and Steve Israel from New York.
One out of four people say they don't vote in federal elections because the weekday is too busy for them. They're balancing their jobs and their schedules and their kids.
So maybe they can't vote on Tuesdays. But currently, the bill to change that is in committee. And there are critics. Secretary Deborah Bowen, for one, believed that it wouldn't be such a good idea to put election on a day of worship.
If you were to move elections to a weekend, you would have to have, you couldn't choose either just Saturday or just Sunday because both days are religious holidays for some people. So you would then have to have a two-day election, and that means, in California, that would mean keeping 25,000 polling places secure overnight with voted ballots. So it would dramatically increase the costs.
Another potential idea would be to vote online. But many Americans do not trust the internet when it comes down to elections.
Like almost all computer systems, voting systems are vulnerable. And when you connect them to the internet, that vulnerability increases.
Bruce McConnell is the top cybersecurity official with the Department of Homeland Security. He recently spoke to a group of election officials and watchdogs in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
The security infrastructure around internet voting is both immature and under-resourced. I would say that it's a fair statement to say that it's premature to deploy internet voting in real elections at this time.
McConnell explained that not even all government departments use special ID cards with the chips to enter buildings or access computer systems. It's problematic and costly.
It's clearly something we could do.
Again, Secretary of State Deborah Bowen.
But you would have to have your own internet. The military, for example, doesn't rely on the public internet for anything that requires security. And then when you start to add up the potential costs, you quickly decide that it's better to continue to use our paper ballots, process them electronically, and have the ability to audit.
The ability to insure against voter fraud is the biggest sticking point for Bowen.
Unlike, for example, an ATM transaction where anybody, and particularly the owner of the account, can go verify that the bank has handled the transaction properly. There's no way for a voter who votes electronically to go track whether their ballot was counted properly. And in fact, there's no way for anyone to audit that transaction.
Currently, the only online tool California is working on is voter registration. Nationally, there is more of an initiative to implement online voting. The Pentagon is looking at that option for the military and U.S. citizens who live abroad. And it is being used in other countries, including parts of Switzerland and Canada, and it's being considered in Norway and the United Kingdom. While many believe that online voting is an inevitable future, it's clear that locally anyway, it's not going to happen anytime soon. In San Francisco, I'm Artem Skonhaus for Cross Currents.
We just heard that U.S. officials believe online voting is not a viable option right now because it's insecure, even though we're increasingly paying our bills and shopping online. One country that allows its citizens to vote in elections not only online but even using smartphones is Estonia. A small northern European nation with a population of 1.3 million. Estonians have been voting online since 2005. KALW's Artiem's Konohoffs met with 27-year-old Estonian Evelyn Kasanum, who currently lives in San Francisco, to talk about how it works.
Okay, first you must have the ID card. That is a compulsory document in Estonia by law. Every ID card has two PIN codes, one for, you know, identifying yourself, another one for digital signature.
And the ID card has the chip inside of it, right?
Yeah, yeah. But for voting, in addition to these things, you must have the computer with the internet connections, also the card reader where you can put your ID card, and you must have also the application to read the ID card in your computer.
You got the ID, you got the reader for your computer, you download the software, everything is fine. So what's next?
What's next? You go to the elections webpage. This says that for voting, you need to identify yourself by ID card or mobile ID. You click on the button, which identification you would like. Then the software displays you all of the people that you can vote for. Okay. And after the next one, you have to, you know, approve it by entering your second PIN code. It means you will digitally assign your request.
And as I understand, there has been no major scandals with regards to the...
No. So that's the issue, that unless it's not proven that it's unsecure, it's not unsecure.
That's Estonian citizen Evelyn Kasanum, who currently lives in San Francisco. She spoke with KALW's Artiem's Kunahovs. What do you think about online voting? Do you trust the internet to carry your vote? And would you vote online if that was an option? You can let us know by posting on our Facebook page. We're KALW News. This is Cross Currents. I'm Holly Kernan. The decline of the Postal Service already has a lot of people feeling nostalgic for the era of handwritten letters and personalized packages. Over at 99% Invisible, host Roman Mars and reporter Julie Shapiro are more focused on honoring the tiny artwork that accompanies our mailed parcels, the U.S. postage stamp.
Get this idea out of your head. A stamp is not a tiny painting.
Somebody might be able to do a great painting 20 by 30 inches, but you take that down to 1 inch by 1.5 inches, and it's a challenge to make it work.
And Ethel Kessler is just one of a handful of people who take on that challenge.
I'm Ethel Kessler.
Ethel's one of just 5 art directors responsible for churning out every single stamp issued by the United States Postal Service each year.
And I've been doing that for 15 years.
Those bonsai stamps that just came out, with the tiny little beautiful meticulous detailed drawings of trees, those are hers.
And our reporter there is Postal Service and stamp enthusiast Julie Shapiro.
Most people think of stamps and then picture flags or the Liberty Bell or the word love spelled in a cutesy font. But there are so many other stamps made every year. What about those abstract expressionist stamps that were all sorts of awkward sizes? Or the Muppets that were on a white background and seemed to be bursting out of the envelopes?
And those new pioneers of industrial design stamps? Oh my goodness.
And I loved the cloud stamps. If you looked at the sheet, they're laid out in the exact same layers they exist in the sky. Every year, there are artful stamps, there are poetic stamps, there are stamps with senses of humor, even surprising stamps. It's just that you don't really see those ones. You just see the flags, the bells, and the love.
Stamps take, on average, a year to a year and a half from conception to execution.
I can just tell you that this process is never succinct.
Basically, the art directors pull together the stamps once the subject matter's been picked.
But as Ethel mentioned, it's a long process.
It starts with public suggestions for stamp subjects mailed to the USPS.
Yes, stamp proposals must be submitted in writing. Damn right, you have to use a stamp.
The first thing is the subject.
And that is our other guest. His name is Terry McCaffrey.
My name is Terry McCaffrey, and I recently retired as the manager of stamp development for the U.S. Postal Service's Stamp Services Office, where I was in charge of designing all the postage stamps for the government.
There are 50,000 suggestions a year that come in from the American public. Basically, all of those subject suggestions have to be gone through and have to be reviewed by a committee.
The committee is called the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee.
That's CSAC for short, CSAC. And that committee serves the Postmaster General.
As you might imagine, CSAC has received some pretty far-out suggestions over the years.
We've received requests for hate stamps to combat the love stamps that we issue every year. One for the devil, one for the passing of the great American outhouse.
But luckily, there are rules that help guide the committee in choosing the stamp subjects.
About a dozen rules.
They primarily feature Americans.
Births, anniversaries, significant contributions.
Dead presidents usually get a stamp.
50th anniversary of historical events.
50th anniversaries of statehood.
No repeats within 50 years, excepting national symbols and holidays.
200th anniversaries of university foundings.
No disasters commemorated.
Keep away from religion.
No, they have honored, of course, Christmas, and there have been a few people, such as Mother Teresa, but we really are honoring her for her humanitarian efforts, not for her religious orders or religious beliefs.
And this one is interesting.
Themes of widespread appeal that reflect the USA's inclusiveness. In other words, something everyone will love.
So being bold and controversial is not what stamp makers are going for, which I think you could view critically too. Although, you know, inclusiveness itself could be viewed as a radical notion to some. But there's one more big rule, and we'll get to that in a minute.
So the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee follows these rules, picks the subjects, runs them by the Postmaster General, you know, the grand poobah of the USPS.
If he's not in favor of a stamp, it isn't going anywhere. But I think he usually defers to the committee.
And assigns them to the art directors. And then the art directors follow their own rules. And the number one thing to keep in mind around the Stamp Services Office?
Our mantra, courtesy of one of the art directors, Howard Payne, was to keep it simple and look at it at stamp size.
But the art directors also consider a few other things.
Keeping it bright and colorful and engaging and making the image something that people will want to put on their envelopes.
What's the feeling you want to evoke? What emotions do you want to evoke?
The social awareness stamps, as we refer to them, are the most difficult stamps to produce because you have to create an abstract concept and sell it to the American public.
And there's one stamp that's been wildly successful in this. Both Terry and Ethel cited it independently.
The first stamp that I have to mention,
dear to my heart for many reasons.
It also happened to be the first stamp that was issued that I art directed, was a breast cancer stamp.
Not only is it a great graphic design and illustration, but it also is a fabulous message stamp.
And that stamp was also the first time in the country that the U.S. did a stamp that raised money for a cause in addition to the postage.
Because you pay an extra 8 cents on the average to purchase each one of the stamps.
That stamp, which went on sale in 1998.
And it's still on sale after all these years.
And it's raised about $73 million for breast cancer research. Just looking at the stamp from the lower left to the upper right, it goes from dark colors into bright colors, layered with a line drawing of the goddess Diana.
Reaching over her shoulder to reach for an arrow in her quiver.
which also has an ingenious resemblance to the line-drawn cartoons from those doctor's office pamphlets that explain how to give a self-breast exam.
Where her one bare breast would have been, they had removed that and put in a slogan, fund the fight, find a cure. So it was a brilliant design.
But not all social awareness stamps are wildly successful.
I think one of the biggest examples of a stamp gone wrong is many years ago, before I joined the group, there was a stamp out alcoholism. But unfortunately, it was one of the biggest failures we ever had, because when the message was sent to another person, that person received it and got the impression that the sender was saying, you're an alcoholic, you need help. And they found that offensive. So that stamp did not work.
As technology pulls us deeper into electronic correspondence and away from snail mail...
A term the USPS hates, by the way.
The USPS has lost billions of dollars, but it's trying to keep up and stay relevant. To that end, in the fall of 2011, they changed one of the biggest rules governing stamp subject selection.
It used to be that first you had to be dead long enough to be on a stamp. And there were lots of reasons for that. In the beginning, it was they had to be dead 10 years. They shifted that to 5. And as most people know, they've just shifted that to even living people can be on stamps. Now you have to start looking and saying, who's the first one?
I had a feeling Terry knew the answer to that one.
Yes, I do. But I'm not at liberty to say. It will not be Lady Gaga.
See, when the USPS changed the deceased subject rule to allow living people on stamps, they asked the public to nominate someone for the first living stamp.
Tragically, nominations were accepted online. No stamps required.
And besides Bob Dylan and, at the time, living Steve Jobs, yep, Lady Gaga was right there near the top of the list.
I said, well, you get what you ask for. Not that Lady Gaga is bad. I love her music. I just think it's a little premature to put her on a stamp.
This open call for the first living person, I see how you could view it as kind of a gimmick to get people excited about the post office and get Lady Gaga fans to buy stamps.
It will not be Lady Gaga.
A boy can dream, can he? But for the people who design stamps, sure, they want you to buy them. But when you talk to them, immediately you know there's so much more to it to them than that.
As Ethel puts it, stamps tell the story of America in pictures.
You work on these things so long and put so much into it, heart and soul, that you just feel like in the end it has to be right. It's for the American public. That's who we're doing this for. And I just want it to be right.
It's something that touches every person in the United States, and it's a product that I helped develop, and I think that to me is just wonderful, and I'm honored to have been part of it.
Oh, P.S. In my opinion, 45 cents, the current rate for a first-class stamp, is an entirely reasonable amount to pay for a tiny work of art that escorts your letter all the way across the country.
I completely agree. For 45 cents, I wouldn't take your letter upstairs, and I'm going there anyway.
Selection 13, Postal Workers Canceling Stamps at the University of Ghana Post Office.
"99% Invisible" was produced this week by Julie Shapiro, the artistic director of the Third Coast International Audio Festival.
I've been telling people I want to get on the Citizen Stamp Advisory Committee. I have a new life goal. That's what I've taken from this little radio project. And believe me, I asked how to do it. I've got some awards to win, apparently. It's not going to happen anytime soon, but I'm working on it.
99% Invisible is produced by Roman Mars with support from Lunar. It's a project of KALW, the American Institute of Architects San Francisco, and the Center for Architecture and Design. To hear more, you can go to 99percentinvisible.org.
You've
You've been listening to Cross Currents from KLW News. The team includes Buffy Almendares, Hana Baba, Julie Kane, RTM's Kunahox.
I got a letter this morning. What do you reckon it read?
Audrey Dilling, Lupe Hernandez.
It's in the gal you love is dead.
Chris Hoff, Erica Moo, Emily Gaddick, Leela Day, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Isaac Silk, Taja Lanier, Angela Johnston, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. Casey Miner is our senior editor, Martina Castro is our managing editor, and Ben Trefney is our executive editor. Also thanks to City Carshare for providing an alternative transportation option to our reporters. City Carshare is on the web at citycarshare.org. And especially thanks to you. Cross Currents is listener-supported radio. Tune in tomorrow at 5. The tough job market means employers have the luxury to be really picky, especially when it comes to applicants with criminal records.
We would be here all day long interviewing people. And actually, you know, 90 people last time applied. So yeah, we do have to filter it down.
That's tomorrow at 5 on Cross Currents.
We've been through some things together.
The music you're hearing is by Sunny and the Sunsets. They've been in the Bay Area music scene for a while, but they've never released a full album until now. The band starts promoting their new release in the Northwest in Canada next month, so your last chance to hear them locally is this Saturday when they'll be at the Independent in San Francisco. Music starts about 9 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Holly Kernan.